Hello there, and welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. My name is Caleb, and I'm joined by Drs. Scott Keith and Adam Francisco. I think this is going to be maybe our last of the apologetic episodes that we're doing in a row. I'm sure as questions come in and things like that that pique our interest, we'll be able to dive back in. But this will be about, I think, week six, if I've been keeping good track of apologetic episodes. And we've been doing the last two episodes before this. We were taking listener questions, and I have some more again, some related, some not related, and we can just sort of dive into those. But before we do that, got some things to announce. We have some Christ Hold Fast City events coming about. I think there's still time to register for the one in Las Vegas if you're listening to this episode. So if you're a resident of Southern California or of Vegas, I can't think of it. There's nowhere in Northern Arizona that would be a close drive, right? I don't know.
Maybe Utah?
You know, I know Vegas is within 3 hours proximity of it-ish of Southern California, depending on where you are and stuff. And it might be worthwhile to join us there. So you can go to 1517.org. There's an events tab there, and you can see the city event in Las Vegas. Both Adam and Scott will be teaching at that event. And
you're teaching in Vegas, Adam?
I am. Oh, Galatians 5.
Oh. The fruit of the Spirit, right? Yeah. So we'll see what Adam does with that. And then
I'm a fruit inspector.
How many times a year do you speak on a topic that's not apologetics, Adam?
Well, not very often.
So this might actually be a really fun city event to come to see Adam sweat a little bit.
For the record, I've made contributions to the Bible.
Oh, you're in the study Bible?
Yeah. That was a bit of a joke.
To the Bible. It took me a second.
I got some biblical knowledge.
It's like, what?
Yeah, I bet you do.
Bible?
So I think that'll be a fun event, and you should check it out. We also have some other announcements. You should, if you go to the 1517 website and you can sign up for the newsletter. You can sign up for contact there. If you support the Thinking Fellows or 1517 through the donation channel there too, you'll be signed up for the newsletter, and you can get basically once a month at the beginning of the month an announcement of upcoming events, books, podcasts, all that sort of thing. And I think that's full of that. That helps you sort of see what's coming ahead. And I do suggest getting on that list if you're not already getting the newsletter. So. You guys ready to dive into some questions? I have one that's specifically for Adam, I think.
I'll just sit back and look at Facebook.
So Adam, we had somebody message us. I put this out on Reddit, on an apologetics thread over there, just because.
Reddit.
It's an area of social media 1517 hasn't really done.
That's on the interwebs.
Done much with. But there is an apologetics.
So Twitter?
Thread. What?
Reddit's like Twitter or a message board.
It's like a forum, a collection of forums, I guess is the best way to put it. And somebody mentioned that their first encounter with apologetics was not Christian apologetics, but was actually Islamic apologetics. And I think they mentioned Ahmed Didat as sort of their introduction to apologetics, and then from him seeing him argue with Christians or debate with Christians, then introducing them to Christian apologetics. And so I guess this got my mind wondering towards the question, what is the difference between Islamic and Christian apologetics, or how prevalent are other forms of religious apologetics?
Yeah, good. There's a lot of questions there. I'll answer the last one first. You're going to have to remind me what the other ones are because I forget very easily. As you know, you will find, especially amongst Muslims, a lot of apologetic activity. In fact, Tariq Ramadan, I think we've talked briefly about him in years past when we've done episodes on Islam. He's been called the Martin Luther of Islam. He's written books like Western Muslims and the Future of Islam, and he's sort of was for a time, I don't know, maybe 30 years, one of the leaders in traditional Islam in Western societies. He's now sitting in jail. But he, in his book, Western Muslims and the Future of Islam, he argues makes a common point that lots of traditional Orthodox Muslim theologians have made, and that is that there is no, not really an Islamic theology. And what they mean by that is that Islam does not have a tradition like Christianity, where you have theologians like Melanchthon or Thomas Aquinas or St. Augustine who write these massive treatises where they draw on philosophy and they synthesize and systematize Christian doctrine and so on. Islam doesn't really have much of that. What Ramadan argues, though, that Islam does have, if it approaches theology comparable to the Christian tradition, is a whole wealth of apologetic literature. Mm-hmm. I mean, some of the earliest Islamic writings were written in response to Christians like John of Damascus. We did an episode on him a couple of years back, who about 100 years after Muhammad's death is addressing Islam, presumably engaging Muslims in debates and so on. And so from that encounter, that first, those initial encounters between Christians and Muslims, there's been a whole lot of apologetic activity. In terms of approaches, I don't know if you asked this question, but generally speaking, the approach Muslims have taken for 1,300, 1,200 years at the least is what we would call presuppositional. Dr. Montgomery has an article that he published long ago in the journal Muslim World, and it's appeared in some of his book, his anthologies, mm-hmm. called How Muslims Do Apologetics. And his point, or the point he makes in that article, is how it's different in terms of content, of course, but in terms of method or approach, it starts with the assumption that the Quran is the word of Allah. And then when the question is raised, well, why should we believe it's the word of Allah? The answer is, well, because Muhammad was a prophet. Mm-hmm. Well, how do you know Muhammad was a prophet? Well, because
the Quran says so.
There's more sophistication in some of the apologists. The last 150, maybe 200 years, there have been developments that are towards a more evidential or inductive approach.
Interesting.
I don't know if this is the starting point, but from what I've read, the starting point seems to be in India in the 19th century when mostly British, Anglican missionaries, by and large, forced Muslims into big public gatherings where they would debate them. And the Muslim intellectuals were completely unprepared for this. But they quickly, after they got beat in these debates, they quickly did their homework and they started accumulating all sorts of Christian literature so they could figure out where the weak spots were. And they quickly learned that the weak spots in Christianity were actually could be found in Christian authors. They picked mm-hmm. up on biblical criticism from the 19th century or higher criticism, and which essentially says that, at least in part, says that the biblical texts as they stand are not reliable. And so Muslim apologists said, see,
your own people
are saying the same thing that the Quran itself says about the earlier revelations, the Torah, the Psalms, and the Gospels.
And we say to our own people, thanks for the help.
Yeah. So that's sort of the beginning. But now Ahmadinejad, to be sure, I would say every contemporary Muslim apologist ultimately is a presuppositionalist, but they cloak it with evidential arguments. So Ahmadinejad, he died, I think, 15 years ago, just after the turn of the millennium. And he was from South Africa. I think he was born in India, though. Was known for hosting or at least appearing in large public apologetic events. But he did leave behind some pretty, they're not famous books, but certainly influential books. If you go to an Islamic bookstore, who among us doesn't go shop at Islamic bookstores, you know?
Yeah, who doesn't? chances,
I'd be willing to wager, and I don't bet, although I did buy a lottery ticket recently because I'm thinking I need to make millions and millions. I didn't win though. I was disappointed. I threw it away in a tough, but anyway, probably won't do that again. But if you go into an Islamic bookstore, I guarantee you there'll be works of Didot. It will be, there'll be three books. There'll be The Choice 1, The Choice 2, which are just a collection of Didot's short little newspaper articles in South Africa, mostly polemical attacks on Christianity. But then there's probably his most famous work. It's called Crucifixion or Crucifixion, ?
Yeah.
And it's not.
That's clever.
I just saw a meme that like used that same thing. It was on Reddit on a different thing, but it was like, if it was true, they would have called it the Crucifact.
Oh, yeah. That's a good one. That's probably from a Muslim.
Oh yeah,
polemicist,
that's
I bet.
Funny.
But what crucifixion or crucifixion argues is that, and Didot knew full well 1 Corinthians 15. If you can undermine the resurrection, you've dismantled Christianity. So he argues this is easy to do. We don't need to worry so much about the empty tomb, however. We can show, he argued, that Jesus at the very least did not die on the cross, but probably more likely wasn't even put on the cross. Now the arguments, if you don't go and buy this book, you can get PDFs of them online. The arguments are awful. And the interesting thing is, in the realm of modern, like let's say 2020 Muslim apologetics, the arguments haven't gotten much better. Okay. Essentially, they argue that there's a more plausible explanation for what happened on Good Friday. That more plausible explanation is that when Jesus was hanging out with his disciples in the upper room, he knew, because he's a prophet of Allah, that he's going to be, or people are coming for him. So he asked his disciples, who wants to take my place? And Judas raises his hand.
Wow.
And so Judas, and he also has a facelift, if you will, that Allah does, causes him to look like Jesus, so he's arrested and put
That's deep into the weeds, man.
Well, it's because they do have to deal with that he was prophetic or had some gifts.
Sure.
I mean, on the cross, so you got to make it so that Judas looks like Jesus
on
the cross.
And, but for them, cursed is the one who's hung on a tree. That's Deuteronomy, I believe. Yeah. And they will go to that verse and say, see, God would not have let his prophet hang on a cross. That would be just inconceivable. So there has to be another explanation. So Judas, or another theory sometimes you'll see floating around is in that mix-up on the way to Golgotha.
I just heard a Christian argue like this, saying that cursed is a... is metaphorical because God couldn't ever be cursed. Right? He would never let Christ
or
really be
Or you could
cursed.
Go with the historic position that he became the curse for us.
Yeah.
You could do that.
Yeah.
But back to this other theory. In that mix-up on the way to Golgotha, people say Simon the Cyrene just looked like Jesus. And that mix-up, he just confused for him. And there's other theories too. There's a book out there called Jesus in India, written by a very marginal... traditional Muslim would say a heretical sect of Islam called Ahmadiyya. And you can go to Kashmir in northwestern India, and you can find the grave of Jesus. He was put on a cross, but he swooned. They'll draw on Western swoon theories, and he looked for the lost tribes in India, and he died there. And anyway, so sort of boil it down for a Muslim apologist like Ahmad Didot, it just couldn't be that Jesus was crucified on a cross, regardless of what the facts. Somebody else took his place. And that's what you'll find is that they will use evidence and what seems like a more evidential or inductive approach only to show.
But it's negative.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not positive for Islam. It's essentially negative against
another
position.
Or it's a way to explain the Islamic position on what happened to Jesus.
Mm. Yeah. So part of this is interesting to me because Islam is the fastest growing religion in the world. Mm-hmm. Most of that by birth rate, not like by evangelism,
right.
Islamic evangelism or something like that. But as far as people who you're going to encounter potentially, if we're talking sort of outside of our realm, I mean that they're going to make up 33% of the global population by 2060, this says. Mm-hmm. So that's, I mean, that's pretty substantial.
Yeah.
Christianity isn't growing at that same rate anymore.
Right.
So the popularity or sort of the presence of Islamic apologetics seems like something Christians are going to have to face a little more, at least publicly, than in the past, right? Because I think a lot of times when we think about apologetics, we think purely about sort of the materialist,
right?
The Western enlightened atheist, or the agnostic college student, something like that. And we don't, I don't think we tend to think about other religious positions as much as...
Right, I think you're right there. And you had originally asked the question about, like, do you find apologetics within other religious traditions?
Yeah.
So in Islam, and you certainly find it amidst atheists, you know, of whatever stripe. You don't really find it, you can if you look hard enough, but it's pretty rare to find like a Buddhist or a Hindu apologist. There certainly are Hindus and Buddhists who are more philosophical, and they can do some sort of what we'd call apologetics, but it's of a very different sort than what we're accustomed to, arguing from facts.
Those religions aren't evangelical, I guess, in that sense, right? There's no necessity or onus put on them to make converts.
Right.
But one doesn't have to be a Buddhist to be enlightened.
Yeah.
Right?
I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's a path, it's a teaching, but it's not the same as Christianity. Say that, where Christ says,
right,
I and the Father are one, no one comes to the Father but by me, here's the one path to salvation. It's not the same thing there. There's not just the one path to enlightenment or whatever.
Yeah.
There's not even a promise of salvation in the same way there is in other...
Mm-hmm. Right. I think even the Dalai Lama, I mean, who among us doesn't read the Dalai Lama?
Yeah, I saw this.
At one point said that if he's teaching to Buddhists, if you encounter Christians, don't try to persuade them differently because they're on their path. Mm-hmm. And if you persuade them differently, you might really cause a disruption towards their enlightenment.
Yeah, I saw a recent thing from the current Dalai Lama that...
Your dad was just shaking his head at that teaching. The Dalai Lama?
that we should sort of shed off religious polemics and focus on material and political change because we should have no aim towards spiritual change, which is...
Who says this?
That was the current Dalai Lama. I saw it somewhere.
Oh, okay.
I might be able to find the link. Yeah. It was in an interview. Sort of a new, I mean, I don't know. It's interesting as the world has, or at least the West has become, seemingly less religious. At the same time, it's just sort of adopted a new, set of religious principles.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, we've talked about that before, that the less sort of, moral the world gets, it just creates a new morality that's in a lot of ways different but stricter societally than many of the religious ones. It's discarded.
So does Islam have an evangelical aspect to it to do apologetics, or is it simply sort of like a defense because Allah deserves defending or something like that?
There is a proactive, positive approach, to be sure. But mostly it is a kind of a clearing away of, or at least as they would see it, a clearing away of all these distractions you have from realizing that Allah is one and so on. Because there is this thing in Islam that says we're all people are born into this world Muslim. It's their parents or other distractions, society,
work you out.
Philosophy,
governments.
That cover over Allah's truth and so lead you astray. So,
interesting.
So, I mean, typically the Muslim apologist is going to be there trying to tear down those distractions or those temptations that lead you astray.
Is there a desire for sort of similar to Christianity for all to be saved or come back to knowledge of the faith? Or is that less emphasized?
It's more... Ultimately, they will come to the conclusion that Allah's elect will become Muslim. That most of the more traditional type don't think you can persuade somebody to become a Muslim in terms of like such that you're doing all the work yourself. Mm. That Allah is working behind the scenes there. And what typically, in my experience, what typically happens is they'll spend time trying to dismantle, discredit Christianity in our case, or whatever person they're speaking to in their worldview, and then they'll make a what they call they'll issue a dawah, a call to Islam. You say, so I've shown you that this is all false and problematic, and you know the truth. Allah is one; He's the Creator, and et cetera, et cetera. The choice is yours, and if you don't accept that choice, if you're in America, it's okay. Probably, but if it's elsewhere, if they call you to Islam,
I like that. Probably,
if you're elsewhere, maybe not so much. If you reject the call to Islam, you're rejecting Allah.
Yeah, I've met several Christians who have fled to the United States for sort of to escape religious persecution.
Yeah. I've met a Christian who's been issued one of these invitations.
Yeah, maybe. Sitting right across the table. I was issued a call to Islam in a parking lot just about 3 weeks ago. I giggled inside and said, okay, I'm going to get my truck and get out of here.
Because if you're in this country, you're okay.
Most of
probably.
Was this the same guy you helped change his brakes?
Or? No, a different guy.
Oh, okay.
Different guy.
Yeah.
I live in a weird world.
Yeah, you make... do you think you make... friends who are Muslim because you're knowledgeable about their faith, or is it just happenstance?
This is just pure coincidence. You know, we all go to the same gym.
Cool. So the next question that I had was two part, but the one of this that I felt interesting was should we have? So we actually did this in one of the episodes with Rod where he talked about. Where we talked about the sort of the common objections to the faith. But the way this person put it is, are there common things we should know or things we should be willing to answer or ask of young people in particular? Mm. And I saw this phrasing about young people a lot.
Youngsters.
That's got me thinking, It seems like people think that apologetics, or at least people who all these questions were coming from Christians, their concern is about that there's this mass unbelieving younger generation below them. Do you think that's a valid concern, or do you think the address to this concern is sort of a apologetics as we've laid it out, or is there more to it than this?
Well, I didn't read the question, but I took it, maybe it was an older Christian who wonders if apologetics should be even introduced to young people, like in, you know, whatever, junior high or whatever, because it can get you thinking and questioning. I don't know, but is that's not it?
I mean, I'm
that's
getting the sense that it is sort of grandma or something like that out there who's just worried that her grandkids aren't believing. And I think most of the questions I've been receiving have something to do with addressing younger generations than me, who I don't understand why they don't believe. I believed. I raised their parents in the church. Why are my grandkids not coming to church? Is this an apologetic issue? Should I be training myself in apologetics to deal with this?
So I've finished up that class at Community Lutheran in San Marcos this week, did 3 weeks on the parables, and I got out and was talking to a group of people and the pastor afterwards, and he expressed interest in me coming back to do something else and said, what would you like to do? And then I kind of paused and he said, well, I've been getting a lot of questions from people at this congregation who are worried about answering questions that their children and grandchildren and even great-grandchildren have about the faith, and they're worried that they're stepping out of the faith and they don't know what to do or don't know what to say. And I'd honestly say every time I teach apologetics somewhere, that's the biggest audience. It's not that there's people in the congregation who don't believe, or that in my opinion, it's not even that there's people in the congregation that are planning out to go out into the quote unquote field of the world and do a bunch of apologetics with strangers. They're concerned about people they know and love. Mm-hmm. And so I told them, I just basically that we could do 3 to 4 weeks on just for the people, not for the children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren, but for the people in the congregation, this idea of, you know, start with know what you believe and why you believe it. And then as you're having conversations with the youngsters, at least you're doing so from a perspective where if they ask you a question, you can know why you believe that Jesus rose from the dead. You can know why you believe that the Bible is trustworthy. You can know why these things. Because as I've seen it, the biggest sort of hang up is that Christians get asked questions to which there are answers. When I say answers, I don't mean that there's like, you give an answer, it's definitively an answer, it's going to shut down the questioning. I don't mean that. I mean, there's an answer to the question, i.e. there's a reason why we believe that Christ rose from the dead. There's a reason beyond just because I believe it, why we believe the scriptures are authoritative. Mm-hmm. That can be helpful in these conversations, but people don't know them. They just, they don't know them. It's a difference between a generation or generations that were told, this is what you believe, this is what was true, and they said, okay. And generations, when you say to them, this is what you should believe, and this is what's true, they say, why? And it's just, you know, in an interesting way, it's the, there's not a whole lot of great society people still alive, right? And so this is mostly baby boomer generation people asking about their children and grandchildren and maybe great-grandchildren by this point. Like, your grandmother is a baby boomer and she's got great-grandchildren. And the irony to this is the generation that shook up the world, right? This is the first generation that sort of shook things up and started these questions coming and being socially acceptable. And what I would normally say to them is, hey, don't be scared of this. You've been asking these same questions when you were their age. It's just hard to remember because it was a bit ago now. This is a natural process for people that are coming up in the faith to have questions. The worst thing we can do is to say we shouldn't ask things like that, or you know, there's not an answer to that question. Anytime I teach this, I start out with the example of Steve Jobs, who was a Lutheran in the ELCA when he was young, and states in several interviews that he left the faith because he asked his pastor difficult questions, which his pastor said there was no answer, and that he just needed to believe. And so he said, well, if it's just about what I believe and what I feel, I'm going to go explore all the other options. And he spent a lifetime in a, you know, at least that part of his life in a drug-induced haze exploring the options.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's absolutely true. I find a lot of, I also think some of the problem is that the objections from particularly people my age, so somewhere between 25 and 30.
You're not 25.
Almost. I'm almost 25. So
between 24 and 30.
Between 24 and 30. You could even say college age. So you could just probably say 18 and 30, right? I find a lot of the objections are not sort of these intellectual objections to say the resurrection stuff. They're not even that far yet. A lot of it is like perceived hypocrisy among the way Christians talk and act.
When I was teaching the basic class at the basic theology class at the university, the biggest objections had to do with the perceived way Christians treat homosexuals and others of the LGBTQ.
Plus, I think. No, there's an F, C, and A.
I don't. Alphabet soup.
Community, right? Yeah. a lot of stuff over sort of, sexual ethics in general, and abortion. I mean, those were the biggies. You know, anytime you got an objection, there was a rare individual who was sort of thinking out maybe like creation versus evolution or existence of God questions, or even, you know, what about the people in the deepest, darkest reaches of the world who haven't heard the gospel yet sort of questions. But that was the rare case.
Most of it was this surface level, sort of in your face, daily social.
Most of it was, I can't be that. Well, why? Well, because they're mean to my friend who's a homosexual. Like, oh, okay. And I was that one was always weird to me because I'm like, well, you're friend with them and they're a Muslim. They're like, yeah. Like,
Wait.
They want to be more mean to your friend than we do. I'm just saying.
Well, like, when people give personal examples, it's usually experiential, right? So, like, in theory, Muslim doctrine and practice concerning these same social issues is as harsh, if not harsher, than Christianity.
I'm going to go in every case harsher.
Yeah. Okay. But their experiences, generally who they're talking about is their parents, who they perceived as...
Because here's the deal. Their friend so-and-so, who's a homosexual, probably didn't grow up in an Islamic mosque felt pushed out of that mosque because they were homosexual. They probably did grow up in a Christian church and felt pushed out of that church because they were homosexual.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a big one. In fact, I could just even sort of people I've met in the meantime of different places I've taught. Camps and whatnot. This is still, I can name people for whom this is a major issue. I mean, this is like a major issue. If Christianity says that homosexuality is a sin, that excludes my cousin so-and-so who's getting married to so-and-so and they're both women, and the church won't do their wedding, and I think that's completely unreasonable, so I can't be a part of it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, the problem is that, apologists especially, tend to deal with this in terms of truth questions.
Right.
And we're answering the question, is it true? We're not answering the question, is it always nicey-nice?
Right.
And
sometimes the truth is very not nice.
So these are different conversations, but at the same time, I think that if you know what you believe and why you believe it in terms of these other things, it can lead you into conversations as to, well, why do you in fact think that is not a sin, right? And have them sort of explore that, and sort of you're able to then tell them that, you know, we're not telling you that this person is separated from the God of love and Jesus Christ forever and ever. We're telling you that within the scriptures, this is considered a sin, right? A sin, like other sins, for which this person needs forgiveness. It can only come through Christ alone. That's a different way of approaching this than they've probably heard before. And I'm not saying they're just going to go like, oh, well, everything's okay now. But it is in my experience, it does stop the conversation long enough for somebody to think about what you just said.
Yeah.
Because you're not just saying, well, they're evil and they're going to hell.
Well, you're actually helping in a substantial way by revealing what the purpose of Scripture identifying something as a sin is, which is to get them to Christ. And I think that's probably the really unique aspect that people aren't getting. Instead of the identification being simply an ends to itself for discovering and correcting immorality.
Yeah, and I don't know that if, rightly speaking, this is Christian apologetics. It might be, it might not. I do think it's sort of engaging in knowing why the church teaches certain things, why the scriptures teach certain things, and what do the scriptures actually teach on these things. It gets more difficult. I mean, some of it, from a Christian teaching perspective, is pretty cut and dry.
Yep.
And the difficulty is in communicating how cut and dry it is with a little bit of compassion.
Yeah, I think, I mean, some of this to me seems like a catechetical issue and even definitions of certain things. Like, people will say that's not loving and the church is supposed to be loving, right? I think it's that person's actually just working with a definition of love, which is not what is meant by God so loved.
I'm going to say one more thing, and we're probably running close to time, so I'll stop. But I think I'm a member of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, as is Adam, as are you. So let me just go with that for a second. And let me just call that our church or the church for just a half a second here. I think the church has to learn how to communicate those truths to this generation better than it does. Because they are truths. These are scriptural truths. They're, you know, they can't be sort of like mealy-mouthed around with, and you can't really change those truths into lies for the sake of duping these people into the faith. But you do need to learn how to communicate them. I just saw something it was on Facebook, so it's probably highly questionable. But I don't doubt it, though, just knowing sort of the students, that 46% of LCMS Christians believe that abortion should be legal, right? Now, the LCMS's official stand is that it's really bad, that it's bad, that it's a sin, that it should not be legal. In fact, we have a lobbying organization in Washington, D.C., of which one of their primary focuses is sort of abortion legislation and working towards getting the Supreme Court to readdress this issue, right? But 46% of LCMS people, could be wrong, I don't actually doubt it, though, believe that this is, that it's okay and necessary. I know for a fact in teaching these classes, as anecdotal as this experience is, that but I've also seen the data that it, it in your generation and younger, it's closer to 100%.
Yeah,
it's and pretty, in your generation and younger, really? Yeah, it's closer to 100% that also believe that homosexuality is just a normal, a normal expression of human love. It's now you have to take off sort of the exceptions, right? You can run into communities of people your age that certainly believe abortion is wrong, communities your age that certainly believe that homosexuality is a sin. But if you sort of generalize this out to the wider population, there's been so much propaganda over the last 40, 50 years on this stuff that you've had sort of progressive generations who've grown up believing these things are less and less wrong statistically by number of people that believe they're right and wrong, to the point where you get to your generation and younger where it's almost universal. And this is at Concordia and Irvine.
Yeah.
A relatively conservative campus.
Right. Yeah, and I've seen, I mean, from working on the student affairs side, I've seen the data of when they're asked these questions, and it's...
Yeah, it's, you know, like you said, I don't think some of this is not strictly apologetic, right? It's doctrinal, even pastoral, in many ways, depending on how the question's asked. I think the apologetic thing is that when you realize that somebody is, their objection to the faith is purely sort of one of these personal, social, or emotional issues, my question is, can you get them to the cross in a way that's not confrontational with that particular issue at that time?
You gotta be sensitive to the age group too, right? Yeah. This is the age group that if you tell them it's wrong, don't do it, you know, it's gonna make them real curious, right?
Yeah.
It doesn't change the fact that it's wrong, and it doesn't change the fact that they shouldn't do it. But maybe you can communicate it's wrong, don't do it, in a way that engages their mind too, and isn't just you wagging your finger at them, which necessarily causes, in a lot of cases, them to go to the other side. I mean, it's possible to teach your children that sex outside of marriage is wrong and not in accordance with God's plan or their well-being or their partners and future spouse's well-being without just wagging your finger. You can engage in conversations. You can talk about why. You can talk about the effects of these things on you and other people and society and the whole nine yards.
Have reasons that are more than Bible said so.
Yes, and get them to the point where they actually believe it because they believe it, not just because you told them that they had to believe it. And the same thing has to happen in these other conversations. And we just, as a church, in my opinion, are not great at that and need to get better at it.
No,
I'll step off my soapbox, man.
No, I agree. I think that's a lot of it. I think a lot of this has boiled down to, you know, I've heard it.
It's wrong, don't do it.
It's wrong, don't do it. And also just because the Bible said so.
Well, it works so well with the war on drugs. I mean,
it's bad, don't do it.
Just Say No was an incredible success.
And, you know, like we've done on the, I think one of the reasons this relates too is because like we've done on this episode when doing apologetics, when you have somebody from the outside with a real objection, simply coming to them and saying, because the Bible said so, generally doesn't do it.
Yeah, that's, you got to be a little smarter.
And I know that's a generalization, but there are versions of because the Bible said so that are more nuanced, but still don't dive into the heart of the issue. And part of
this
is
there are teachers at school that are mandated to teach them classes where they're told to be sensitive to these people groups are going to be more astute than saying, because I told you so.
Right. Yeah, they'll have whole reasons from human compassion to flourishing to...
You're from the Christian tradition, for Pete's sake. Mm-hmm. We have a tradition of reasoning through what the scriptures teach and what we believe and how to communicate it to society. We can do this.
Mm-hmm.
We just have to do a better job at it.
Yeah, I think that's a, I think that's a reasonable answer. And I think it butts up against one of the things is that apologetics falls within this realm of general Christian education and catechesis that needs to sort of be, I think, revitalized and can be sort of revitalized as a unit. We've gotten pretty used to, again, like in my anecdotal experience, pretty surface-level Bible studies that tend to repeat over the years and things like that, and not as serious doctrinal engagement with these issues, definitional engagement, apologetic engagement. And I think 1517 has been trying to help churches with resources and speakers and stuff like that do deeper extended dives into these issues. And I think if you're at a church that is looking forward ways to expand its adult education, young adult education, things like that, we have free resources at 1517 that can help you facilitate this. We've been hearing actually lots of stories from pastors who've been able to use things like our academy, podcasts, various series of blogs and things like that to assist in teaching Bible studies. Not obviously can't do all the work, but and if you're interested in using those materials or have questions about that, you can contact us on the website and we can help walk you through how some of those might apply.
And that website is
1517.org. And again, there's a contact form on there and lots of tabs. You can skim through some of that. And if you're just a Thinking Fellows listener, this may be one of those opportunities where you can expand towards some of those other things we offer. I know Bethany Long Beach was recently using Adam's apologetics course in their Bible studies and things like that. I think there was a church using your Augsburg Confession course as well. We've had people write in and say they've been able to use, say, like some of our 15 episode long series on X
early on. We got that a lot with the Lochi series.
Yeah, with Bible studies. And so if you that is a long time ago. So if you have questions about that too, I've helped people work through sort of maybe even building a syllabus, so to speak, out of some of our materials to engage with, if you need to cover a couple months of Bible study or something like that. But I think that's one of the things here is with the conversations that we're having, this isn't just trying to bemoan what is happening in the church, but I think there are actual ways to improve some of this. And some of this is actually just stepping up our game when it comes to educating parishioners and lay people.
Yeah, and parents.
All right, guys. Hey, thank you for listening to this episode. If you found this episode or other things 1517 helpful, it would be awesome if you could help support us financially through 2020. You can go to 1517.org/donate. When you go there, there's a page where you can set up a, either a one-time donation, which is great, or even better, a monthly reoccurring donation on there. You can make it for any amount, whatever is affordable for you. That would be fantastic. We appreciate that help. Also, big thank you to the people who pushed us over the 500 reviews on Apple Podcasts.
Oh, I didn't even know that had happened.
Yeah, that was great. So that actually just happened like 2 days ago from recording this. I went and looked, and there was like a burst of 30 reviews. The guilting must have worked on that. But hey, if you haven't done it yet too, that's a subtle reminder there. We can still go much farther. There are still many listeners out there who have not yet reviewed the show. So thank you for those who did, and I'm looking forward to reading some of the more reviews from others who haven't yet. So thanks for listening to this episode. We'll catch you next time.
Bye.
Bye.